Hare Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahana Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navadhi Tamastuma Vidvishavahai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Now the glory of the Brahminical order. Man is stated to be pure above the navel than below. Hence, the self-existent Swayambhu has declared the purest part of him to be his mouth. So it's just like when you're doing puja and things like that, then if you touch anything below the navel, then you have to wash the hands. If it's above, then it's not as important. Like that. And so then, of what's above the navel, then the mouth. As the Brahman sprang from Brahman's mouth, as he was the firstborn, and as he possesses the Veda, he is by right the Lord of this whole creation. For the self-existent Swayambhu, having performed austerities, produced him first from his own mouth, in order that the offerings might be conveyed to the gods and the mains, and that this universe might be preserved. Okay. Biti, that this universe might be preserved. By sacrifice, the gods are nourished. In turn, the gods nourish the plants and herbs. Thus, mankind is maintained. By this mutual benefit, the universe is preserved. Right? Because then feeding a Brahman is considered a very, proper activity. So that works because they are the mouth, they sprang from the mouth of Brahma. They're technically the mouth of the Lord. So through them, then, offerings can be made, and also their service is then explaining the Shastra. What created being can surpass him, through whose mouth the gods continually consume the sacrificial viands, and the mains, the offerings to the dead? Of created beings, the most intelligent are said to be those who are animated. Of the animated, those who subsist by intelligence. Of the intelligent, mankind. And of men, the Brahmins. Right? Because those intelligence, you have those who, they just go out and eat and this and that. Then there's those who actually make plans how they're going to eat. Like that. The monkeys do that, the lions do that, things like this. So they're considered superior. Then of that, then mankind. And of men, then the Brahmins. Of Brahmins, those learned in the Veda. Of the learned, those who recognize the necessity and manner of performing the prescribed duties. Because you have someone who's born in a Brahmin family, may have the qualities, but he's not educated. So therefore, for himself, then that's good, but he won't be able to explain it to others. So the actual point of the Brahman to study and teach is not actually obtained. Right? Okay. And then those who recognize the necessary, those who are learned, then those who understand how to perform the sacrifices, the necessity of performing some duties. Because otherwise, you may be learned, but you cannot teach the lifestyle to someone else and the importance of it to someone else. Right? Does that make sense? So in other words, the element that you are practicing and you're going to teach that to others and get others to practice that, that's the most important element. Okay. And of those who possess this knowledge, those who perform them, right? Because there's those who will preach about it, but then those who do it, that's better. And of those, of the performers, those who know Brahman. Right? So, of those who are following the Vedic lifestyle, they understand it, they preach it, they follow it, than those who know the Supreme Lord, they're the best. Right? So you understand this thing. So this is how you say, being given as the standard. Lord Chaitanya explains this, Srila Prabhupada explains like this.
Those who know Brahman, they are not specifically Vaishnavas, though.
That is there, but the thing is someone who knows, but up to now, who has been explained as Brahman? Yeah, because Vishnu. Because whenever they use the term Brahman, they mean Vishnu.
So they mean Vaishnavas.
It would mean that they know Brahman, so then someone who knows Brahman will be better, someone who knows Paramatma will be better than that, someone who knows Bhagavan will be better than that. But the term that they're using of Brahman is always referring to Vishnu. Right? But in any case, even if someone, let's say, is an impersonalist, he's better than a Karmakandi. You know, because he knows further. Like his position is further. Right? But here we can understand that Brahman specifically would mean, according to someone who understands Vishnu. Right? So, we would define that as Vaishnavas. Mm-hmm. Right.
But can we say that Manu Samhita is a general scripture, not like Srimad Bhagavatam is more into Vaishnavism, let's say?
Okay. Be thou pleased. The great sages approached Manu, who was seated at the collected mind, and after duly worshipping him, spoke as follows. Be pleased, O Divine One, to declare to us precisely and in due order the sacred laws of each of the four chief varnas and of the intermediate ones. For Thou alone, O Lord, knowest the purport. In other words, the rites and the knowledge of the soul taught in connection with and for the purpose of realizing the self-existent, means Lord Vishnu, who is unknowable and unfathomable. It's written in language that general populace would appreciate. But it's specifically for knowing how to perform your prescribed duties in connection with and for realizing Vishnu. You know what I'm saying? So it's because all the Vedic literatures are actually meant to know Vishnu. But depending upon the literature, it's written in that language so that that particular kind of conditioning can appreciate it. Right? The Bhagavatam is written so the Paramahamsas appreciate it. So it's all the knowledge, you know, the essence of all the knowledge, all directly in connection with the Lord. Well, this is how to connect the indirect. Well, there it's showing the direct. From that, you can understand how to apply the indirect. Right? Does that make sense? So because it's dealing with, the other scriptures are dealing with the indirect, people may forget its connection with the Lord. There, but all the scriptures, like Ayurveda, Jyotish, any of it is for knowing the Lord. But people will forget and think that it stands on its own. You know, so that's where it then becomes avidya. Right? And, you know, avidya is quite popular.
All right. It's fair to say on this point regarding those who know Brahman, but unless one knows Bhagavan, and they don't actually know Brahman.
Yes, you could say that. You could say that. Because Brahman's not complete on its own. Because Brahman is coming from Bhagavan. So to only be a Brahmavadi, you're not actually knowing Brahman. You could say he knows Brahman, but he doesn't actually know Brahman. So we would explain it. That means, so of those who know Brahman, those who know Vishnu, that's the ones that actually know Brahman. But at the same time, as here, just as Brahmins, someone who knows Brahman would be quite respectable. Right? You know, like that. But still, higher than that is one who knows Vishnu. The very birth of a Brahmin is an eternal incarnation of the sacred law, for he is born to fulfill the sacred law, and thus comes to realize Brahman. Okay? So, birth of a Brahmin. Brahmanam janatiti brahman. No brahmana. One who knows Brahman is known as a brahmana. Thus it is the second birth which qualifies one as a brahmana, as stated in Manu. of him who gives natural birth and of him who gives the knowledge of the Veda. The giver of the Veda is the more venerable father, for the birth for the sake of the Veda ensures eternal rewards both in this life and after death. Let him consider that he received a mere animal existence when his parents begat him through mutual affection, and when he was born from the womb of his mother. But that birth which a teacher acquainted with the whole Veda, in accordance with the law, procures for him through Savitri, or Gayatri, is real, exempt from age and death. Therefore, by consciously practicing the values and lifestyle of the Brahminical culture, and becoming inquisitive into the nature of existence for the purpose of realizing our eternal relationship with the Lord, does one actually achieve Brahminical status? Right, so that's there. So, but someone being appearing, his whole, who has the potential, it's for the purpose of studying and teaching the law. Right? Because when we say this is Dharma, so Sanatana Dharma means understanding the law in connection with the Lord. Because the here it doesn't get, it will, but not as much as other scriptures like Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam, that they will explain that the Dharma of the soul, because that's the most important of all the types of Dharma. Right? So you have a Dharma of what is the social nature and how everyone can progress and be prosperous. You have the nature of facilities. You have the nature of the senses. You have the nature of liberation. Right? But the highest is the nature of service to the Lord. Right? So these are all the aspects of Dharma. So Sanatana Dharma means that, so it includes all the others, because your activities, your facilities, your senses, and your situation are all connected to the Lord. Does this make some sense?
Maharaj, can you say that previous time in the during the reign of Vishnu Maharaj, there was no law like state law?
There was no state law.
Yeah, like right now in India we're having a state law, like parliament system. So there was only the law given by the Krishna and Manu Samhita somewhere. There's no separate
system. No, it means why Yudhishthira Maharaj, even during the time of the British? The British used Manu Samhita to manage the Indians. They had used their English law for the Englishmen. You know, as long as you didn't offend an Englishman, then you wouldn't come under English law. But amongst themselves, they use that. It's only the Indians have started this, gone away from that, their actual culture. Right? Swaraj was for the purpose that you could become economically and politically independent from your own culture. That's the purpose of Swaraj. Right? No?
I think so.
Yes.
So that's their revolution?
Yes, because see, is that you put Mahatma Gandhi in the front because he was the one pushing it. But they wanted Swaraj since 1850. It took them basically 97 years to get it. But they put him in the front because everybody could get behind him because he was basically apolitical. So everybody would support him. But the people who were actually pushing the movement of that, they wanted to just westernize India. They just didn't want the British doing it. They wanted to do it themselves. You know. You know, their point is this, you know, why the Mughals and why the British should be ruining India. We'll ruin it ourselves. It's our country. Yeah. Right? You know, so like that.
Mainly Nehru has that agenda.
Yeah, so Nehru is. So that's why, you know, Mahatma Gandhi wasn't very happy at the end, because then it turned out to be just simply political. It wasn't about establishing the Indian culture. It was about, you know, about just politics, that's all. Yes.
All right.
So, connected to the point Prabhuji said, he says here, one does not become an actual, does not achieve actual Brahminical status if he does not realize an eternal relationship with the Lord. It's just one paragraph, the last paragraph we read. It says, therefore, by consciously practicing the values of life, by Brahminical culture, and then in the end it says, the nature of existence for the purpose of realizing our eternal relationship with the Lord, does not one achieve actual Brahminical status Mm-hmm. He's saying that unless the Brahman comes to that...
Yeah, then he's not actually a Brahman. He's born the Brahman family, so if you respect him, then you get benefit like that. So you give him charity or anything, you get double the benefit of giving to a common person. But if he's actually studied the Veda, you know, then you get you know, and you get like 10,000 if he's realizing 100,000, you know, like that. It goes up. If they're Vaishnavas and realized, then it's unlimited. There's no, like doing something for Prabhupada, it's unlimited what would be the results. So that he's pointing out the position of the Brahman. So we're taking it that someone is on that platform. Mm-hmm. Like that. And thus comes to realize Brahman. We just read through it. Here again. You asked your question and then we read that, but it was right here. That was the next point. Okay. A Brahman coming into existence is born as the highest on earth, the Lord of all creatures, for the protection of the treasury of the law. Because unless the law is protected and taught and practiced, you don't have human life. If you don't have human life, very difficult to elevate yourself to the transcendental platform. Right? So that's the whole. So that's why the Brahman is more important. Right? As far as organizing, seeing that everything goes on in a proper basis, therefore the Kshatriyas are there, that you have facilities, the Vaishyas are there, and that it's actually practically applied, the Shudras are there. But all that, it only has meaning if it has the direction of the Brahmins that it is going towards transcendence. Otherwise, then it doesn't have any real meaning. A Brahman eats but his own food, wears but his own apparel, bestows but his own in alms. Other mortals subsist through the goodwill of the Brahman. So he's saying here is everything in the world, it belongs to the Brahman. So if someone gives something to a Brahman, then it would be like taking Ganga water and offering it back to the Ganga, or a lamp and offering it to the sun. It's not that, yes, I'm the Vaishya, I've made this money, it's my money, now I'm giving it to the Brahman, now I'll get all kinds of piety. The piety is coming is that you're recognizing the position of the Brahman and respecting him. But the money that you have, even though you may have worked for it, belong to the Brahman anyway. Like that. So that's the position. So those who understand it, but the point is the Brahmins don't need much. So they're happy that everybody else has their stuff because they think it belongs to them. So that's fine. Just like everything belongs to them. Why the Brahmins? Because they understand it belongs to the Lord. Right? So in other words, everything technically belongs to those who understand its relationship to the Lord. Right? But the ones who don't understand this, they claim proprietorship. So to not disturb the minds of the ignorance, you as long as they use it properly and everything. Then. In order to clearly settle his duties and those of other castes, according to their order, the wise Manu sprung from the self-existent, composed these literatures of the sacred law. Okay. Lord Brahma sprung from the self-existent, from Lord Vishnu, composed these institutes, right? So Manu then put them together so that they could be explained. Right? So again, we have here is bringing you back to the Lord. Seems to be very smoky. Now, as soon as you move it to a place where it won't get in our face and the wind will change and it'll blow outside, then you don't get the benefits. So you get one or the other. It's either in your face or you get no benefit. So.
Sorry, I don't understand.
It's Smriti. It's tradition. So it will be the Veda itself is Aparusheya. Then you have those who follow the Veda. Then they explain the important teachings, generally in connection with a particular topic, so that people will appreciate it, right? And then, it's known as Smriti. But that means it's because that's their practice. So then it's also known as tradition. That will be coming up at the end of this chapter. Right, about tradition. A learned Brahmin must carefully A learned Brahmin must carefully study them, and he must duly instruct his pupils in them. But nobody else shall do it. In other words, other than the Brahmins who have studied and are practicing should teach it. Because others would not understand what it's for, right? Because it means there's a good chance that anything you've heard about Manusamhita, you know, from the devotees, they're just saying it's just an economic system, just a social system. So, no, it's transcendence expressed through social system. In other words, how to engage the social system in the Lord's service. Right? Just like Ayurveda is how to engage, you know, the health of the body, the mind, and the words in the Lord's service. Right? Because if the health is good, then you can be active.
Alright. So, Srila Prabhupada, he wanted us to preach every member of the society.
Right.
This means that by preaching, we come up to the Brahminical level?
Yes. Yes, because the point is you know the Vedas, and you know the essential points. I mean, we not knock to everything, but nobody knows necessarily all the Vedas. You know, so what aspect you know? And you know you're practicing what teachings it's given, and you know that the purpose, the ultimate goal is the Supreme Lord. So that puts one on the Brahminical platform. That's how it works mechanically. So Vaishnavas are automatically on the Brahminical platform. It doesn't mean that one is Brahminical by occupation, other than the preaching part. You know what I'm saying? Because the occupation of a Brahmin is to preach. Right? So that aspect, but also studying and teaching and these things are part of, you know, ashram. Because we see the Brahmacharya life as he's studying. It says ashram duty, so that means he has to have a teacher to teach him. You know what I'm saying? So, but if you're looking at how to make money, then only those with a Brahminical conditioned nature, you know, whether they're devotee or not, that's not because the Brahminical conditioned nature would be involved in that activity. Does that make sense? So in other words, this is not to be. Manusamhita is not just for anybody to teach, because otherwise they'll put an economic spin on it or some kind of modern social spin or any of these kind of things. That's why you never hear anybody discussing it. But everybody just stays away from it, you know. But a Brahmin who studies these institutes and faithfully fulfills the duties prescribed therein is never tainted by sins arising from thoughts, words, or deeds. Because it covers all. Body, mind, and words is covered by here. He sanctifies his company, his kinsmen, seven ancestors, and seven descendants, and he alone deserves to possess the whole earth. And so just by studying these and practicing them, then anybody he associates with is purified, his family members are purified, and seven generations before and after, you know, and including himself, so 15 generations are purified. Right? Yeah, and they alone deserve to possess the whole earth, because they'll know what to do with it. Everybody else has some other idea of what you should do with the whole earth. Right?
We're speaking here about Brahmins by, not only by ashram, but by occupation.
Like that. Means, in other words, to have an appreciation and to practice, then that is the, you know, that is the Brahminical culture. And then one who knows the Brahminical cultures for knowing Brahman, means for knowing the Lord, they're Vaishnavas. So they're the best of those following Brahminical culture. So by following Vaishnava culture, you're automatically following Brahminical culture. So one is a Brahmin by ashram. It doesn't necessarily mean by occupation, other than the Bhagavad platform of preaching. Right? So that's the topmost. But when we drop it down into the how you say, the Pancharatra or into specifically the Vedic, then there'll be a difference, because then you're considering conditioned nature. Right? On the Bhagavad platform, anybody can preach, because everybody is servant of Krishna, so that's their position. So they talk. So preaching is there to do deity worship, you know, for yourself, or if it's depending upon the style of worship that's going on, anybody can be involved. But you'll generally find only someone with a Brahminical nature could be a full-time pujari, right? Because one is you have to be able to be fully absorbed like that all the time. Two is you have to be satisfied whatever you get from that, So that's Brahminical. Is that make sense? That's the whole idea. So then you're dealing with the conditioned nature. But as far as preaching goes, who can give the Bhagavatam class, who leads the kirtan, you know, who does the artik, that's okay. That any Vaishnava can do. Right? Does that make sense? But here to study and to teach Manu, then that would be for someone who is on that Brahminical platform or the Vaishnava platform and has the Brahminical conditioned nature. Because then you don't try to interpret it according to the Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra perspective. Like that. Because it's for realizing Brahman, so it should come from that platform. Does that make sense? Now, if you have somebody who in their life has practiced these other aspects, but by practice of devotional service, comes so strongly fixed on the devotional platform that he's not interested in the worldly activities, so he's just preaching. You know, performing sadhana, preaching and all that, then if he is teaching this, that's fine. But generally speaking, such a person wouldn't be so interested because they've elevated themselves beyond varnashram. Like that. It's very enthusiastic.
It's a concert.
No, it's quite concert. What is it? Gadadhar. Oh, what's his name? Satyabhama. In her book says that they're all chanting Gauda.
Maharaj, but let's say Kshatriyas, original Kshatriyas.
Original Kshatriyas.
Kshatriya as a cost is became degraded as well. But, let's say, didn't they used to follow in the laws that they...
They follow the laws, they implement the laws, but they don't teach them.
Okay.
It means they have their court, and if you're following, then, you know, no problem. If you're not following, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
Right? But that's their business. They apply it to see that the social system is going on, but they don't teach it. The Brahmins teach it and ensure that the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, understand it. The Kshatriyas will therefore see that it's being implemented. And then the Vaishyas and Shudras will function within that. To study this work is the best means of securing welfare. It increases understanding. It procures fame and long life. It leads to supreme bliss. Right? So supreme bliss. Always, now how they'll use these words. Because it's a type of language, this Vedic language. Supreme bliss. Now, for a Karmakandi, supreme bliss means going to heavenly planets. For the Jnani, supreme bliss means attaining Brahman. And for the devotee, supreme bliss means obtaining one's relationship with Krishna. So you'll always see, as they always use this, the supreme destination, supreme bliss, supreme goal. Because it makes it that everybody in the culture will follow it. Because if it was so direct like Bhagavatam, you know, do the impersonalists and the Karmakandis and that read Bhagavatam? No, so that means they won't practice what Bhagavatam's saying. But the problem is if they did that with the social system, there'd be no system for the Vaishnavas to function within. You know what I'm saying? So you have to, it's written that it's meant for realization of the Vishnu. But in case one doesn't have that as a goal, at least you'll follow it socially. Right. In this work, the sacred law has been fully stated, as well as the good and bad qualities of human actions, and the immemorial rule of conduct to be followed by the four varnas. Right. So the sacred law has been fully stated. So there's everything. It covers everything. Right. It even gives... If there's something that you're giving an example of, but it's something that's very specific that you don't know how it falls, then Manu gives how to deal with that. You know, what would be the method? The rule of conduct is a transcendent law, whether it is to be taught, whether it be taught in the revealed text or in the sacred tradition. Hence, a twice-born man who possesses regard for himself should be always careful to follow it. right, to taught in the revealed text or in the sacred tradition. So that could either mean in the Veda, and then the sacred tradition is the Smriti, so Shruti and Smriti, or meaning here, then in the Smriti, and then how the great personalities follow it. Like that. A Brahman who departs from the rule of conduct does not reap the fruit of the Veda, but he who duly follows it will obtain the full reward. So here again, it's not just saying the Brahmins are the cat's meow, and that's it. It's a matter of, yes, the Brahmins are the best if they're following it. Right? In other words, he knows it, he practices it, he follows it, he teaches it, then they'll get the benefit. Like with someone who disregards it, he won't get any benefit. Is that what it says? The sages who saw that the sacred law is thus grounded on the rule of conduct have given good conduct to the most excellent root of all austerity. So proper behavior is the root of austerity. That's why good behavior becomes so prominent. Right? But people can misunderstand that good behavior stands on its own. It's only important because it therefore is the basis of prescribed duties. Like someone says, oh, if someone's immoral, that's bad. But why is it immorality bad? Because then how do you perform your prescribed duty? And if you don't engage your prescribed duty in the Lord's service, then what's your connection with the Lord? You know, in the nature of your conditioning, right? But some will say, no, morality is just good on its own. And when they go to apply it, they're not referring to austerity, which means the prescribed duties, and those duties being connected to the Lord. Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty that may arise. Okay, so next, 1b, to the 25 topics of the sacred law. So now it says the sacred law, all the different aspects, these are the 25 aspects. So one, the creation of the universe, right? Because you have to know how it comes into existence. Two, the rule of the sacraments, means the samskars. Three, the ordinances of studentship, brahmacharya. And four, the respectful behavior towards gurus, right? It's how the brahmacharya has to respect authority. Five, the most excellent rule of bathing, means how at graduation, like that, on return from the teacher's house. Six, the law of marriage, because then if you're going to go into grihastha, you have to know the law how to get married. Seven, the description of the various marriage rites. Right? There's the principle of marriage, and then there's the rites that you use. Eight, the regulations for the great sacrifices. When everybody, at grihastha, then he has debts to everybody. The brahmachari, the vanaprastha, and the sannyasi don't, but the grihastha does. Because you're born in, it means you have a position. That's there because of forefathers. That's your facilities are taken care of the demigods. Your rituals you perform are given by the sages. Right? The Brahmins are there to teach that. The living entities are there. It means you're able to do what you do because everybody else does what they do. Right? So you have these five debts. The eternal rule of the funeral sacrifice of the Shraddha rites. 9, the description of the modes of gaining subsistence, how you maintain yourself. 10, the duties of a snataka, means someone who has graduated from the gurukul, what are his personal, lifestyle duties. 11, the rules regarding lawful and forbidden food, because your purity is maintained by what you eat. Right? The purification of men and things, if anything becomes dirty, whether it's people or things, then how to purify them. 13, the laws concerning women. Because besides this, the women will be following this, then they have their own specific duties, their own unique duties. 14, the law of hermits, or vanaprastha. 15, the manner of gaining final emancipation and of renouncing the world, sannyas. Right? So now we've gone through, everything comes into position, right? What's the proper spirit? What's the proper mood? Then samskaras, then brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, right? So then ashram dharma is finished, right? So that's brahminical culture, right? As far as that. Now we get into varna dharma. 16, the whole duty of a king, right? The overview of what he is, what his lifestyle is, what his attitude is, right? 17, the manner of deciding lawsuits. Within his duties, he has to maintain court, right? Then 17a, the rule for examining witnessings. Let's see. How do we do this? Okay. So these are rules within this, and then these will, when we get to it, these will, the 18 kinds of lawsuits will fit into here. So the rules for examining witnesses, because you have to know if the witness is bona fide or not. The laws concerning husband and wife. The law of inheritance. Inheritance and division. 17d, the law concerning gambling. And 18, the removal of men noxious like thorns. In other words, those people who make trouble for society, how to identify them, how to remove them.
Can we study this in depth, or just...
We're going through at this level that we're going now. So if you consider this in depth, then that's in depth. If you consider this just a cursory study, then we're doing a cursory study. The point is to be way deeper than you've ever gone through before. In other words, we will also cover the first point of the Talmud, that if you have a trench and your neighbor's bull falls into it, whose responsibility is that? So that will be covered. You don't have to worry. 19, the law concerning the behavior of Vaishyas and Shudras. Right, all half a page. 20, the origin of the mixed caste, how Varna Shankara comes into place. The law of all caste in times of distress. In other words, if there's no Varna Shankara, nobody has difficulty in the performance of duties. When there's Varna Shankara, then there's a proper difficulty in performance of duties. And the law of penances, right? How to correct things if you aren't properly performing your duties. Then 23, the threefold course of transmigrations, like how the modes of nature work, what bodies it produces, how one moves through these bodies. And 24, the result of good and bad actions, what you get for what action. And 25, the manner of obtaining supreme bliss, and the examination of the good and bad qualities of actions. So how to attain transcendence and how to examine good and bad qualities of action if it's not, you know, specifically dealt with by mind. Like that. So only someone who knows all of the previous then would be qualified to make a decision on this second half of this last point. The primeval laws of countries, of castes, of families, and the rules concerning heretics and companies of traders and the like, all that mana was declared in these institutes. So that's all the in-between. He said all the main and then in-between. So these are all the in-between. Okay. See these. Okay, it says that means these 25 are in chronological order. It just goes one after the other. So we'll go through there. There's only one thing that's stuck in between two of them, because it's so big. It has preliminary. Then you can understand the topic. Then it has further, like that. And I think that's in the third chapter. The other topics, then they come interspersed throughout, because they may come up, family things come up here and there, traders come up here and there, like that. As Manu, in reply to my questions, formally promulgated these institutes, even so learn ye also the whole work from me. So as Brahma taught it to his sons, you know, in this case, Bhrigu, right? Then Bhrigu asked questions, and as he got answers and all that, the discussion went, as that went, is he's going to explain it now. Right. So discourse two. Right. So this goes a little quicker. That was 119 verses. Okay, discourse two, 1b, 3. Desire for results, the basis of action. Learn that sacred law, which is followed by men learned in the Veda, and assented to in the hearts by the virtuous, who are ever exempt from hatred and inordinate affection. So again here, attachment and aversion. Right? So that's the standard of those who, you know, understand, who practice, teach this law. Right? It's the same. So in other words, the qualifications that the Gita is talking about, the qualifications that Manu is also mentioning. So we see this, there's no difference. It's just the language is a bit, how do you say? more complex, right? You know, to be a little bit more poetic and stuff. To act solely from a desire for reward is not laudable, right? It means you do an action because you get a result. That's not actually glorious. Yet, an exemption from that desire is not to be found in this world, right? But everybody's going to do something because there's a result. Right? So that's why we say the result should be for Krishna, because you can't act without desiring a result. But if the result's for Krishna, then it becomes devotional.
Prayojana has to be there, right?
Yeah, prayojana has to be there, otherwise why you'd work? Like that. For on that desire is grounded the study of the Veda, because you want to get some benefit, right, either material or spiritual or transcendental. That's why you study Shastra. Otherwise you wouldn't study. And the performance of the actions prescribed by the Veda, and therefore you practice what it says to get that result. So therefore desire is not bad because of that aspect. Right? So in other words, if desire is meant for elevation, then it's good. A real elevation is devotional, because the other two then are, you know, give a temporary result. The desire for rewards indeed has its root in the conception that an act can yield them. Right? So that you are interested, that you have the idea that a result is attainable, means that therefore an action will get it. So what's important are your actions. Right? Because your action is what gets it. Right? So therefore you have to have laws concerning what's proper action and what's improper action. And in consequence of that conception, sacrifices are performed, because therefore you do auspicious activities because you know they'll give you auspicious results. Vows and the laws prescribing restraints are all stated to be kept through the idea they will bear fruit. Right, so something you should do, something you shouldn't do, you're only doing it because you think, I'll get something from that. So as long as that something is in connection to Krishna, it's fine. If it's not in connection with Krishna, but in connection to Shastra, it's pious. So at least you're following the culture that is supportive of the Vaishnava ideal, right, which is the actual purpose of the Veda. So to ignore that, that would be not fruitful, not useful. Not an act here below appears to ever be done by a man free from desire, right? So anything that will be described through this whole work, no one's ever followed it because he had no desire, right? So desire is there, but it's to follow the law to get the benefits that the law accrues. So if that's done in connection with the Lord, it's transcendental. So that's the purpose. For whatever man does, it is the result of the impulse of desire. Right? Because from desire, then the need comes, so you see the result you want, and therefore there's action. So therefore all action is based on desire. Because desire will turn into, need for a result, then there'll be action.
Right? So he's defining desire as the origin.
Yeah, the desire is the origin. Because you've contemplated the field, then you've seen something, right? You look at something, you say, hey, we could get this out of it. Then you think, yeah, I'll be happy with that, so you act. So that's why knowledge is important, so that you understand what's available. And that you have desire is fine, as long as that desire then is the results for the Lord. But if it's for yourself, then that becomes a problem. So at least if it's pious, then that's, you don't disturb anybody. But the point of Manu is, the sages know what is good stuff that doesn't disturb anybody. They've come to Brahma, in this case, to find out how to take what doesn't disturb anybody and connect that to the Supreme Lord. Right? So that's the point of this one. Okay. He who persists in discharging these prescribed duties in the right manner reaches the deathless state, and even in this life obtains the fulfillment of all the desires he may have conceived. So here you see again the deathless state. So the heavenly planets are known as Amara. Brahman is known as, you know, deathless. But actually the only real deathless is, this, you know, Vaikuntha. Does that make sense? You understand how it can be taken in the way for your general pious person, but it's actually meant to indicate the transcendental, because you have to base everything on the invocation. right? Like Prabhupada mentions, Brahma Sutras. The first one is the Tato Brahma Jigyasa. It means now is time to inquire about the Supreme. That means the whole Brahma Sutra is about inquiring about the Supreme. It's not something else. Right? So, in other words, this is how to understand these laws in connection with devotional service. That's actually its purpose. Though people will use them otherwise. Mayavadis use Bhagavad Gita for their own purposes. The Karmakandis use it for their own purposes. Right? But because they use that, therefore we can preach very nicely to them. They'll listen to us because that you go out and go, you know, go down to Wall Street and start teaching Gita, it's kind of like, what are you talking about? You know, you got to use, you know, their acharyas. You know, they're not. Okay. The source of the sacred law. The whole Veda, Shruti, is the first source of the sacred law. Now this is where we're getting, this is a very important section. This defines what is Vedic. Like that, because mostly devotees will take Vedic as some theory, and you know, but we have to be practical. But this shows that no, that's a wrong understanding. The whole Veda, Shruti, is the first source of the sacred law. Next, the tradition, Smriti, right, means what is spoken by the ancients, right? Like this, Manusmita is spoken by Brahma. And the virtuous conduct of those who know the Veda further. Also the customs of holy men. Right? So the conduct of virtuous men, you know, that means there can be previous acharyas like this. And then customs of holy men, those saintly persons we know, advanced persons. You know, so guru, sadhu, and shastra. So shastra is there in two forms, Shruti and Smriti. Right? A guru is there as previous acharyas, you know, present acharyas, like that. And then you also have the customs, you have sadhu. So that can also mean previous or present. Right? And finally, self-satisfaction. So you have to have all these four. If you don't have, if you're not applying all these four, you haven't applied the Vedic principle. So to say Vedas are theory, that means you don't know how to apply it. That's all. Just say that. Don't say the Veda isn't practical. Say, I don't know how to apply it. Right? Of course, that doesn't look good for your false ego, so no one's going to say that. Like that. Yajnavalkya states, Shruti, Smriti, the conduct of pious men, self-love and desire begotten of perfect determination, are held to be the sources of religion. Right? So self-love means you're wanting to see the actual proper elevation of yourself. And we know that technically, self-love can only mean if you're interested in establishing yourself as a devotee of the Lord. Anything short of that means you're envious of your own self, actually. Like that. So, in other words, the Shruti, the Smriti, the conduct of pious men, which means those who follow the scriptures, right? Then the desire for self-realization and the desire begotten of perfect determination. So, therefore, you want that and you're willing to apply it. So not that just it's there, but you're willing to make the effort. Right? That combination. Whatever law has been ordained for any person by Manu, that has been fully declared in the Veda. For that sage was omniscient. So there's nothing that Manu declares that's not in the Veda. There's nothing in the Veda that's not in Manu. Right? So whatever is the proper conduct anywhere. So if you understand this, you understand what is the conduct of everybody in the Vedic literatures. But a learned man, after fully scrutinizing all this with an eye of knowledge, should, in accordance with the authority of the revealed text, be intent on the performance of his duties. So you should study this and then be intent to do what is your duty. Right? Means whatever you're supposed to be doing. You know, it's just like we hear that chanting the holy name is the best benefit, and it's the best austerity, it's the best activity, it's the perfection, it's the goal, it's the process. Then we should take it up and do it. Right? That's the idea. For that man who obeys the law prescribed in the revealed text and in the sacred tradition, it gains fame in this world and after death, unsurpassable bliss. Right? So in the revealed, the scriptures say, and then in the tradition, how the great personalities have given it to us. Like, so for us, we have the scripture, and then we have the purports. Right? So between those two, then we are fixed, we know what to do, and we practice. Right? So from that, then one will get how you say? Gains fame in this world and after death unsurpassable bliss. So that means then if one does that, then one goes back to Godhead. Does that make sense? So it's not following Manu you go back to Godhead. It's understanding that Manu gives the forms through which you're supposed to connect to the Lord. It's connecting to the Lord that you'll obtain the unsurpassable bliss. You understand? So it's not that someone could say, see here, if you don't follow Manu, then you're not... No. It's the Manu deals with all the rules, and so therefore anything in your life, you have a way to know how to connect it to the Lord. Does that make sense? That's what's going to make it good.
So Manu gives not only the rule, but also how to connect it? Can you say that?
You would say is that that's why it must be studied by the Brahmins and learned from the Brahmins, because that's what you're going to get. He is giving the main form of it, but he's speaking, who is he speaking to? Remember in the beginning? These great sages. So in other words, it's for the leadership of the society. Does that make sense? So that means, it means the Vaishnava position. So then it's a matter of taking that. In other words, you have a desire, you want to do something. So Manu gives the rule on how to deal with that. Now, so what's right and wrong, that's been given by Vishnu himself. So that means if you're doing what's right, that means that it will be pleasing to him. If you're doing what's wrong, it's what's not pleasing to him. But the reason that you're doing it is because it's pleasing to him, not because by doing the right thing, then I'll be elevated to the heavenly planets to get some other benefit. That's for the less intelligent. The real intelligent knows that he's given the sacred law. That means this is how he wants human beings to act. But that's just the form. The real point is that you act in that way in connection with him, to please him. That's what makes it devotion. Just like you cooked. If you have a cookbook, it tells you how to cook, but it's already been stated that you're supposed to cook these things for Krishna's pleasure. You know what I'm saying? So when you go through the recipes, it's not that each recipe tells you that when you're mixing in, you know, the salt here, the baking soda there, that, you know, how that's going to bring you to remembering Krishna. No, you're trying to cook for Krishna. So in other words, you're trying to follow the social tradition so that it's a form that is agreeable to these, you know, in other words, to those things of not being overly attached or means being attached or, how you say, repulsed by, you know, in other words, affection or hatred of the material environment. You know, it means you're trying to bring yourself to the transcendental platform. So this is conduct that's purifying. Is that okay? Yeah.
Can we say that? Because Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he knows the samhitas and smritis. Yes. So for him it was easy to give the decisions.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So he would just see it and interpret it through whatever would be the law that would be the accepted law. Like that. Plus he can also, when we get into it, you know, through the aspect, through the all these other nuances, because he gives about, I don't know, I forget how many, 8 or 10 different ways that the king is supposed to understand if the person is involved in the case, whether they're telling the truth or not, like that. So then, knowing all this, then, you know what I'm saying? It means the Sanchari Bhavas, they deal with all the different things so you can understand what's the mood, so therefore you watch those. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Okay. But by Shruti, revelation, is meant the Veda. And by Smriti, tradition, the institutes of the sacred law. So in this case, we're applying it here. Shruti means the Veda. Smriti, in this case, we're talking, means Manu Samhita. Right? It can also mean, you know, Charaka Samhita, the Ayurveda. It can mean all these other ones. But here it's specifically meaning Manu. Right? This is the application we're applying it here. And those two must not be called into question in any matter, since from those two the sacred law shone forth. This is a very important point. You can't question them whether they're right or wrong. You can question your understanding of it, and if you're applying it properly, but you can't say, oh, Manu's wrong here, or the Veda's wrong. That's not an option. Right? Like that. Every twice-born man who, relying on the institutes of dialectics, debate, treats with contempt those two sorts of the law, sources of the law, must be cast out by the virtuous as an atheist and a scorner of the Veda. So in other words, if you're just using your intelligence and you're using debate to argue against the Shruti and the Smriti, right, or in this case means the Veda and the Dharma Shastra, then that person, you know, should not be associated with. They're just avoided. Right? Because, you know, here's an atheist, because who's given this law?
Vishnu.
He gave it to Brahma, Brahma explained it to his sons, and the sons are speaking it to us. Now you are dealing with Brahma, right, and Bhrigu, right? And Bhrigu is considered the top of all the Brahmas. Right, so there wouldn't be any mistake here. It's not that, you know, there was something didn't get, you know, they forgot it between Lord Vishnu and Bhrigu, right? You know, between, you know, three generations who got lost, right? You know, so no, we're not talking about that. So therefore, it's an atheist, because they'll say, oh, this doesn't connect, this doesn't. No, it does connect. Maybe we don't know how to connect it, or it may not be important for us, because we have to be able to judge what is lower applications of the principle, what's higher applications of the principle. But just because it's a lower, it's meant for somebody. If it's not for us, that's fine. You know, it's just like we see this big pile of banana trees sitting there. That's food for the elephant. It's not our food. But that doesn't mean, oh, this is not food, this is nonsense, this is that, you know, who would call this food? You know, no, it's elephant food. But the principle of food remains. So if you doubt that, then you doubt the principle of food, means you're doubting what Vishnu. And Vishnu has given banana trees to elephants to eat. So therefore, it's atheistic. So one can discuss how to apply it, not whether it applies. Just like what Prabhupada's given in his purports, we can discuss how to apply it. We can't say it doesn't apply. We can't say that, oh, Prabhupada's from the spiritual world, he doesn't actually understand the material world. These are all atheistic statements. Right? Like that. It's not a matter of, oh, no, but everybody has the right to express. Yeah, you have the right to express. But when you express atheism, we also have the right to cast you out and have nothing to do with you. And if need be, call you an atheist. See, it totally gets fun when we start getting into it. The Veda, the sacred tradition, the customs of virtuous men, and one's own pleasure, they declare to be visibly the fourfold means of defining the sacred law. So one's own pleasure means one is satisfied, one is comfortable in the position. You've taken the laws, and you've applied it to your situation, and you're comfortable with it. So that means now it's complete, it's proper. If you're not comfortable with it, means there needs to be some adjustment. Not in the Shruti and Smriti, or in what the Acharya is, it's how you're applying it. So in other words, when you talk this and then someone says, no, but what about time, place, and circumstance? This is time, place, and circumstance. Because time is Krishna. The place has been created by Krishna. The circumstances have been created by Krishna. He knows what's going on. The knowledge of the sacred law is prescribed for those who are not given to the acquisition of wealth and to the gratification of their desires. In other words, yeah, to those who seek the knowledge of the sacred law, the supreme authority is the revelation, Shruti. So the Veda is the supreme authority, and from that is coming the Smriti. So the knowledge of that is prescribed. In other words, those who should study, those who should know, those who should teach, is only those who are not given to acquisition of wealth or to the gratification of their desires. Does that make sense? So that's why then it's limited to the Brahmins for that. And anybody who wants to practice it seriously, then they also should be following this to the best of it. It means they're acquiring wealth according to their occupational duty. But the point is the performance of their duty, then whatever wealth comes from that, that's the natural. And then they'll engage that in the Lord's service. That's fine. But they're simply trying to get money or trying to fulfill their desires. That's the problem. But if they're getting money and engaging their senses in connection with Krishna, then they can study. Does that make sense? So in other words, again, it comes back to all these same verses that we're studying in Gita. Right, it's second chapter. Right? But when two sacred texts, Shruti, are conflicting, both are held to be law. Right? If you see, well, there's contradiction. So devotees that get bewildered, oh no, but Prabhupada says here this, and Prabhupada says here that, or this scripture says this, that scripture says that. Right? Said anything to upset her? Or, oh, it's just 5 o'clock. Okay. Both are law. You just have to see what applies in what situation. There's never a contradiction. This idea, though, but one acharya says this and the other acharya says that, and there's no such thing as contradiction. They're talking about two different applications, that's all. Thus, the Agnihotra, here's an example. Thus, the Agnihotra sacrifice may be optionally performed at any time after the sun has risen, before he has risen, or when neither sun nor stars are visible. That is declared by Vedic text. Now, you could say, but, you know, what is it? Is it when it's fully dark, or when it's at the twilight, or when it's after the sun's risen and it's fully light? You know, which is it? It has to be one of those. Who said it has to be one of those? All three are correct. Now, the point is if you are someone who just before, what do you do during the Brahma Muhurta? What is the time meant for?
Meditation, Krishna.
Meditation, right. In other words, we chant. Why do we chant? In relation to this. Why is chanting chosen?
Because any activity performed at that time you perform.
Okay, yeah, you get the most benefit. But what do we consider the greatest benefit?
The holy name.
The holy name. Therefore, we chant during the Brahma Muhurta. Right? You know, there may be great benefit from doing things on email, but you know, it's done after that. Right? You know, at that time we used to chant. Right? Does that make sense? Now, let us say your sadhana is yajna. When are you going to do yajna? In the Brahma Muhurta. Therefore, before the stars and the sun, neither sun nor stars are visible. Okay? Right? Now let's say you're worshipping the deity. Right? Right? But doing yajna. Then you'll do it after you've done the Mangalarti or the puja or things like that. You understand? Or if by other sadhana and that, it puts it even later, then it's fine. Does that make sense? So it depends upon what you're doing, then that clarifies it. But it's not that, oh, there's a contradiction, which do we do? We don't know what to do. So that means don't study that. If for you there's a contradiction, then either find someone who can explain it, or don't talk about it as a contradiction, leave it, pray Krishna will reveal, or don't read those things. You know? If you find a contradiction between Vishwanath and Baladev, don't read them. Right. Know that for whom the performance of the ceremonies beginning with the rite of impregnation, Garbhodan, and ending with the funeral rite, Antyeshti, is prescribed, while sacred formulas are being recited, is entitled to study these institutes. Right? In other words, someone technically who is born by Garbhodan, and will, you know, die with Antyeshti, they should study these things. Right? So how would that mean? That means your parents, then they practice these things, and you have children of someone who is going to perform the, and you've trained them, therefore they'll perform the ceremony for you. You know, it's not just about yourself, it's about what you're doing, what you're associating with. Because if you haven't produced someone who is going to do these rites for you, then that means how have you passed it on? So in other words, someone who's practicing it, who's teaching it. Does that make sense? That's the person who's qualified. Right?
So Maharaj, one who knows that last rites have to be performed fantastically and all, so then they will be like inspired to teach their children, have Garbhodan Sanskar and all, otherwise he won't be performing.
Yes, yes. Those who don't care won't talk about it. You know what I'm saying? So the point is what they're meaning is someone who is the following the Vedic culture is their lifestyle. You know, they have received that, and they're going to give that to others. That person, then therefore, these things are for. Right? So now, for us, because we could say, well, we're not necessarily born by Garbhodan and we're not sure about Antyeshti, but we know we're going to die, but we don't know what's going to happen after that. So the point is we're receiving this tradition from the spiritual masters who are born into the tradition, right? And we're going to leave through that tradition, right? You chant Hare Krishna, you remember Krishna, then that person is qualified. Right? Because on the material platform, there's not necessarily qualifications, right? Does that make sense? Because it'll be nowadays hard to find someone who actually has these material qualifications. So therefore, they have to be, our qualification actually comes from Pancharatra. And the only way we can get Pancharatric benefit is because we're of the Bhagavad, we're chanting Hare Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? Otherwise, we don't have qualification here. So it's not that, that's why we don't argue over the material, you know, that somebody's materially doing something wrong, and only on that point, because we're not from a, from the status that we can be the one arguing about it. Because technically we shouldn't be discussing it because we're not from that either. So that was Prabhupada's point. If you go by that, Manu says we're not qualified. Right? So it's because of devotional service only. One qualifies oneself. So therefore, everything in this literature has to be seen in light of devotional service. If it's not, if we try to use it materially, it will always fail. It will always create disturbance. Just like any material activity creates disturbance. It doesn't matter if it's Vedic or non-Vedic. Right? It's just the Vedic will create problem pleasantly. Right? Well, the other one will not be so pleasant. Yajnavalkya states, the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and the Shudras are the four Varnas. Of the first three are the twice born.
Of the first three.
Well, you could also, if you put a comma, of the first three. Oh, yeah, it should be the first three.
Of the
first three. This is poetic. All their rites from the very conception, Garbhodan, to death, Shada, are performed with the recitation of mantras. Right? So that means, one is that the mantras are used for them. Others, you might perform the rites without the mantras. And what it means by without mantra means without the swaras. It doesn't mean the mantra is not used. It's just the swaras aren't used. Swaras are the intonation of the notes. Garbhodan takes place in the proper season. Pumsavana, before the moving of the fetus. Samantanayanam, in the sixth or eighth month. And Jatakarma, after delivery. Namakarna takes place on the 11th day. Nishkraman on the fourth month. Anaprasana in the sixth month, and Chaudhakarana should be performed according to the practice of the family. With this performance of rites, the sin begot of seed and womb is dissipated. Right? In other words, from the mother and father. This actually would go a little bit later, I think. Because this is
all the same as this later on. And I just put it in here just to give some information about what the rites are.
Oh, okay, okay.
From this one to that one.
Oh, okay, okay. Because otherwise these could go down and telling the time and everything. With this performance of rites, the sin begotten of seed and womb. Seed means father, womb means mother. Right? In other words, the mother and father, there's impurity in their consciousness. So you get that conception. So by these samskars, that's purified. You're purified of the polluted consciousness of your parents through these samskars. In the case of women, these purificatory rites are performed without mantras, for only their marriage is accompanied with mantras. So in other words, you do the samskars, but the mantras are chanted without swara. But the marriage ceremony, that's chanted with the swaras. Because that's considered that everything is contained within that. Like that. So the marriage ceremony is actually is a ritual for the girl. So therefore, it's all about the girl. You dress up the girl, it's all about that, everything's happening there. The guy, you know, he has to be there, otherwise how do you have the marriage? But it's all about the guy, or girl, right, you know? Okay. Okay, so and here, then we'll continue on Monday. So we're surviving so far. Yeah.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki, Jai Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Prema Nandi.